Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Anniversary, faithless listeners, and oh, sorry, my mistake. Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 133 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
And why did I make that mistake about anniversaries? Well, today is Hayden's 100th episode of the Diddly Dum podcast. Hooray!
Crazy.
Ooh.
Crazy, 100. I've never done 100 of anything.
I was saying to Mark Cochran earlier this afternoon, he'll have to come on the podcast again, because eventually Hayden's going to catch him up one of these days.
I reckon I'm about 350 episodes behind Mark right now.
How does it feel, Hayden? Do you feel middle-aged, or do you feel... A great achievement.
Let's just say that I feel all of those previous 99 episodes.
Do you feel like a man?
I feel like I've matured during this. Yes, this does feel like Hayden's Doctor Who bar mitzvah, this one, actually. You're going to carry me around on a chair towards the end, though. Chanting, there's no such thing as macra. There is no such thing as macra.
Right, we'll start off with apologies to listeners who noticed that Hayden's rare use of a hand mic last time resulted in so many popping sounds with his plosives. I suppose it was lucky that we were discussing Horns of Nymon and not the Pirate Planet. Although, to be fair, when I was editing it, I knew there'd be a problem right from the start when we started making those jokes about personal protective equipment.
It wasn't me popping, it was me spitting during the Horns of Nymon. Reappraisal.
So how far is Mark away from receiving his telegram from the Queen?
Right, let's have a look at the back catalogue. Mark. I'm just getting the registration list out of the Diddly Dum Museum right now, and I am just casting my eye over Mark's vital statistics.
I like what you see.
Yeah. Mark's on 72.
Oh, well, you have the 28 to go, Mark. Which, curiously, that's interesting, isn't it? Because 28 was the one you first joined on, Hayden. Is that a coincidence, or...?
Actually, yeah, that's peculiar, isn't it? It can't be a coincidence.
So I must have joined 28 episodes after... Hayden, who joined 28 episodes.
No, because I've missed some, haven't I? Oh. Time.
It must be. Oh, that's almost like... Wow, that could have been spooky, that, couldn't it?
But it's not.
Because to put this into context, Mark, you're 31 episodes ahead of Alan.
Right.
Because you haven't missed one since the first one you ever did. In fact, you're the only member of Diddly Dum. I don't think you've got the longest streak. No, that's Doc. Doc's got the longest streak. Doc has been on the show constantly since episode 42. Mark's been on the show constantly since episode 63. Mm. Whilst I've had 4 breaks. Oh, bloody hell. Matt had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And Alan had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's not too bad going.
Was 41 the one that Mark and Alan did alone?
No, because you were still in that. you were still in it, you know.
I left a message, didn't I? That's right.
Yeah, yes. You left a message. That one was the the infamous coup of the museum, wasn't it?
Of course, yeah. Well, listeners, to celebrate Hayden's 100th episode, we're doing one of his favourite stories today.
Oh.
We're going to take a look at the Web of Fear. But we have a few things to talk about before that. Did we all see the all of the doctors on the big night in on Friday the 24th?
Yes, I did. I didn't see it live. I wasn't going to sit and watch it live. I waited until the clip was tweeted out later on.
Well, I heard a rumour, and I'm not sure if this was confirmed or not, that Doctor Who clip was supposed to lead into the clapping for carers at 8 o'clock.
Yes, I've heard that, yeah.
But apparently Prince William submitted this little clip that was a complete surprise to them just hours before, which then meant that the Doctor Who clip was pushed back about 40 or 50 minutes, at which point Doctor Who fans on Twitter were just kind of something along the lines of, who the hell does Prince William think he is? Which was fine. I saw an awful lot of people making comments about, why is Jo Martin there? Well, it's because in the show, she's played the Doctor, and in the clip, they say, at one point or another, we've all played the Doctor. I wondered if there was going to be some fallout online as to why Christopher Eccleston wasn't taking part again.
Yeah.
Which did strike me as slightly odd, but it looks as though he has quite strong views about the NHS not being a charity.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that was the reason why he didn't appear, apparently, according to the interwebs. I thought it was quite nice, but, oh, bless him, that camera angle didn't flatter Tom, did he? Or as he will now be known, Margaret, 83 from down the road.
Oh. You can't say things like that.
I mean, I'm having a real Tom Baker rewatch in reverse at the moment. It's great, you just fast forward the tape till right to the very end, then you rewind and watch it.
I'm not sure that makes any sense.
Basically, I'm watching his seasons in reverse order.
Yes, yeah.
Yes, that's what I meant. And it made me smile when he came up on the screen, so I wasn't sure if he was going to be there.
It was lovely to see him on screen, wasn't it?
Mm.
He didn't have quite as many lines as the others, did he?
No, no. Although you can always tell which ones are the most popular Doctors when they have like a little clip of, coming up, we've got Doctor Who, and they showed David Tennant, Tom Baker, and Jodie Whittaker. Also, just one other observation. Was Matt Smith recording his lines from some kind of gothic cathedral somewhere?
I don't know.
Because he seemed like candles everywhere and very gothic. It was like he was coming from a Philip Hinchcliffe story.
So what are you up to in your Tom recap?
Okay, so today I finished off the Key to Time season and I watched The Armageddon Factor. Do you know, I must be going soft in my advancing years because I actually really enjoyed the series.
Oh, it's a great series.
For the first time as a fan, I could watch the Key to Time series and found something in every story which I really enjoyed. I think it was just such a shame that I think Krull really suffers from not having a real focal point villain, I think. And when you've got a wealth of talent on screen, mostly about 80% of it is Philip Maddock, you know, why not cast him as the, I don't know, it's peculiar. I could have forgiven them for a better realisation of villain in that story.
Yeah, I find that hugely enjoyable, though, that episode. But again, I think that might be because of the fact that I was, you know, I remember it from my childhood, and I remember being absolutely terrified of Krull.
Oh, the Krull's brilliant. Like, as in the actual model, you know, the puppet or whatever it is of Krull. Very well realised.
And the thought that it had its tentacles just going out all over the place through that swamp, and you couldn't see where they were. It was very, it kind of gave me that sort of Jaws-like terror.
It's almost like sort of in the first episode of Terror of the Zygons, where you see bits of the monster before you get the big reveal at the end. You know, I quite enjoyed the build-up there, but I think, and this is going to be, we've spoken about this in the in the Diddly Dumb Smokers room, but we've spoken about our opinions on Mary Tam as Romana.
Yeah, what I was going to say, what was it that you particularly enjoyed about the Armageddon Factor, Aidan?
What was it that I particularly enjoyed?
Yes.
The end?
I mean, just a Vision of loveliness in a white dress.
That is quite a dress, isn't it?
Why couldn't they have even kept the dress on for season 17? If the actress wasn't going to be there.
Oh, I'm not sure Lala had the legs for it, but...
No. Well, I mean, I like Lala Ward, and I think because there's so much more of her as Romana, and she stars in stories like The City of Death and Full Circle, and maybe stories which are a little bit more loved across the scope of Doctor Who fans, not just those who grew up with season 15. I love her as Romana, but I actually prefer the dynamic of Mary Tam's Romana with Tom Baker, because they're like brother and sister. You know, they're on equal footing, and there's little moments where they get the better of one another. And I love the interaction, you know, in the Rebus operation, the, I'm going to call you Fred. It's like, I don't like Fred. It's like, well, it's Fred or nothing. It's like, oh, fine, call me Fred. Okay, come on then, Romana. That's great little interaction. And she does get the better of the Doctor on occasion. But isn't it interesting how there's companions who seem to be the Doctor's equal, and they only ever last one series? Like Liz Shaw as well. And Zoe, actually, when it comes to the intelligence scale. But no, Mary Tam. Really, really enjoyed Mary Tam's Romana.
And Dodo.
And Dodo. That wasn't even a series. She was gone after a few stories, wasn't she? I mean, therein lies her impact. But no, Rebus Operation I enjoyed. Pirate Planet's probably the best of the... Pirate Planet and the Stones of Blood are the best of that series. Androids of Tara was thoroughly enjoyable. Power of Kroll... Again, enjoyable, but I think, again, it stands with my principle. I think the Graham Williams era, and I said this last episode, is that the stories do sort of diminish in quality as the series goes on. The Armageddon Factor's got some great moments. I like the Shadow.
Yeah.
And I like the premise of there being a baddie who knows more about the Doctor than the Doctor thinks that he's let on. I think it suffers from Pertwee syndrome of having to be a six-parter. You know, it could probably be quite a good four-parter. But there's just a bit too much padding there in a series six. And Valentine Dahl, of course, at the end, he's actually quite sinister when they sort of do that positive to negative effect. His eyes are a bit incredibly evil. But yeah, overall, it's not a classic series, but has greatly improved in my estimation.
No, that's nice. Yeah, it's one that I think I'll have to rewatch, and then I'll probably listen to the Doctor Who Show podcast, because I think they've done a whole podcast on that season, haven't they?
Yes, I just finished listening to it about half an hour ago.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, thanks for the mention, guys. Thank you. It's nice to be name-checked.
Oh, yes, can I just say, with regards to our last podcast, can I just do, before we go on, a big shout-out to the Friends of the Nymon.
Oh, for goodness sake. No, you can't, Mark. I want it stricken from the record.
Both of them.
No.
You and Mark Cockrum.
Mark Cockrum, indeed, Nerdology. Also, Ham-Fisted Bap Vendor on Twitter. Dave Kitchen of the Doctor Who Show. Dylan Rees. And the New To Who podcast as well. All now Friends of the Nymon. And I'd just like to say thank you for your support.
If you have been affected by anything that happened in the Haunts of Nymon, then please call the helpline number at the end of the episode.
How many Friends of the Nymon have you seen today?
Three.
Have we been following these tweet-alongs?
No.
No, I haven't, but I will go back and reread the Russell T. Davies' thread on the episode, or Stephen Moffat's. So I did go back and explore them later on, but I don't catch up with them live.
I did the first one with Rose, but I found it a bit too awkward trying to watch a video while at the same time reading people's tweets.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think what RTD had sensibly done is he prepared some particular nuggets of information to tweet out at various points in the show. So it wasn't, I mean, it would have been even worse if it was some interaction between him and the people, because I'd never been able to concentrate on that. But I've not done any of the others since.
When they first started doing them, I'd just watched the ones that they... Because we did our Eccleston retrospective, which meant I'd watched Rose. Yeah. And I'd watched... I can't remember if it was that or it was the Day of the Doctor one first, but I'd just watched Day of the Doctor as well. So I've not really been taking the part in them, because I kind of feel like I've got behind, if you know what I mean. And again, I don't think it's my thing anyway. I'll read them at a later date. I can't watch and tweet at the same time. It's difficult enough breathing and talking at the same time. So,
no, there was some controversy, wasn't there, over the last one? Did Paul Cornell write a sequel or a prequel or something to Human Nature, Family of Blood?
Oh, right.
Oh, did he?
And I don't know. I think it might be one of the things. I think it might be one of the threads that Philip Morris starts cropping up in as well.
Oh, for God's sake. All right, okay.
I think Paul Cornell put it online for everyone that he hasn't blocked to see.
So all 10 of them.
What was the controversy, Mark?
Well, I don't know because I didn't read Paul Cornell's short story. I think somebody was saying it was him messing with canon and he was showing no respect to the Doctor Who canon. And also he was revelling in it because Paul Cornell had tweeted out about, "I've always said there's no Doctor Who canon and I'm glad to leave it in bits at the side of the road tonight." And people going, "How dare he glory in the destruction of our precious Doctor Who canon?" And I don't really know what it was all about, to be honest. I didn't get involved. If I haven't read it, then it's not canon, is it?
What his tweet along did bring to light was just how many people he's blocked.
Yes!
We're very proud to say on the Diddly Dumb podcast, Faces and Sisters, that Paul Cornell has blocked our Twitter feed. Not quite sure. Everyone says, everyone who's mentioned us have been blocked as well, seems to have said, I can't think why. I've never interacted with him once.
Yeah.
So,
I think it's rather strange.
It might be some sort of software that you can download to your Twitter that basically if somebody, you follow somebody who Paul Cornell doesn't approve of, it automatically blocks you.
Oh, right. Oh, what a prick. talking of penning new canon stories, did either of you see the Russell T Davies penned Farewell Sarah Jane?
Yes.
No, I haven't seen it, to be honest. I needed cheering up, not saddening down.
Yes, so it was quite emotional, but I did have cause to groan at one point. I'm not sure if it was more at RTD or at the reaction of some people online. Among all the past companions turning up for Sarah Jane's funeral service were a nice couple from Australia, Tegan and Nyssa. And it got reported in the press as they're becoming, and I quote, "romantically attached after years of fan speculation." Really? I carry on quoting from this source. "This romantic connection isn't something Davies has pulled from thin air. Some Doctor Who fans have long suspected that Tegan and Nyssa were more than just friends or TARDIS mates."
What, some 13-year-old boys in the mid-80s used to think, "Cool, they're sharing a room."
"The pair were undoubtedly close during their travels with the Doctor. And while this was portrayed as more of a strong friendship or girls sticking together on early 1980s TV, some modern viewers have interpreted their developing friendship as a budding romance that was never fully explored. And this unspoken connection between Tegan and Nyssa has previously been a source of Doctor Who fan fiction." Now, I mean, some of the fan reaction online was of the, "we always knew it was true. What a triumph for same-sex representation." And fine, I've no problem with that. I mean, no problem with that, with the fact that Luke apparently is 5 years into a marriage with his husband. I don't even have any issues with there being that sort of relationship with two companions, but Nyssa and Tegan? I don't know if their relationship does deepen in the fan novels or in Big Finish, but my recollection of their relationship during their time in the TARDIS and the Peter Davison era, which was that they were vaguely nodding acquaintances. You know, if they'd met each other in the queue for the TARDIS bathroom, they would have smiled politely and said, "Oh, morning," and sort of prayed that didn't trigger a conversation. You know, just banging on the door saying, "Adric! How are you doing in there?" I mean, yeah, give us a same-sex relationship if you want, but at least make it between two people you can believe.
Well, not only that, but remember what happened to Nyssa. She stayed on in Terminus, didn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she wouldn't go. But the way I read it when I saw it was a couple from Australia, Nyssa and Tegan. I thought there was a comma in there, so there was just a couple from Australia. Who was that? You know, it didn't necessarily have to be Nyssa and Tegan, but yeah, I don't know why Nyssa ended up.
There was more sexual tension between Jamie and Ben than between... In fact, there was more sexual tension between Jamie and Ben. All that rivalry. in things like the moon base is very homoerotic. There's a good reason why Ben's Royal Navy uniform cap shows the name of his ship to be HMS Teaser. What it made me think of was, though, that Ian and Barbara were at least believable as a couple. I mean, having learned, oh, they eventually become a couple, do they? You could at least rewatch their stories and think, oh, yes. Look, they're in a situation where they find themselves acting as a pair of surrogate parents for Susan. And you can see them working closely together because they're the only humans. You know, they're being almost thrown together in more ways than one because of having to handle what's happened to them in the TARDIS. I don't see how you could rewatch the Peter Davison era stories knowing that Tissa and Negan become a couple and think, oh yes, that look or that scene could be interpreted as, oh, that's foreshadowing a romantic relationship. It's bizarre.
I think the tenderest moment was Nissa's farewell in Terminus, wasn't it, probably?
Yeah.
Which was still quite understated, but beautifully done.
It actually almost trivialises same-sex relationships. It's saying you don't actually need any feeling or emotional attachment. All you need is for this sort of relationship is just a pair of matching genitals and that's it. The
thing is, if you want to look for any sort of relationship in Doctor Who fan fiction between any character, it's all there on the internet somewhere, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, look at the Kirk and Spock fanfiction out there.
What's it called? Slash fiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think it's fair to interpret after years of fan speculation as after years of fan masturbatory fantasies. Right. Have we got anything else to talk about? Because before we start talking about the Web of Fear, I do have something to put on display in the Whoseum.
Oh.
Now, you'll know that the Diddly Dum Whoseum is like the Great One on Metabilis 3. We sit at the centre of a giant web with our tentacles, that's octopuses, with our tentacles reaching out across the world throughout our network of global spies. And through that network, something has been sent through to us this week via the diplomatic bag. Now, I've got it here. I've got a copy for each of us. They're rather fragile because they were printed in the 1930s. But it is none other than the official rulebook of the League of Ovaltinis!
We are the Ovaltinis, little girls and boys!
Oh!
Wow.
Sent out to every new member of the Ovaltinis, along with their membership badge. It's got a picture of us, the three of us on the front.
Oh, doesn't Hayden look young with his blonde locks?
Mark, I had no idea that you used to cosplay as Jeremy Clarkson back in the day.
Hang on, which one's that?
The one on the left.
I'm slightly worried about the hand signals.
Oh, yeah! I just
Well, you'll find out about this. This is the official rulebook containing the secrets that only a member of the League of Ovaltinis may know.
Does that mean you have to Spider-Man this bit out?
If only the member of the League of Ovaltinis can know these things, then automatically that means that we're in the club. These secrets are strictly private, only for the eyes of members and their parents, who are considered honorary members. If it should be accidentally lost, anyone who finds it should return it at once without reading to the owner.
Oh, secret wigwag signs. When you put the forefinger of your right hand against the right side of your nose, it means, come over to my house after school.
Tapping your Ovaltini badge with the forefinger of your right hand three times means, let's go home.
Yeah.
Means, get your coat, you pull.
Yeah, exactly.
Closing your fingers in to make half a fist and shaking it from side to side means, Doc, are you sure this is the League of Ovaltinis?
Here are the seven golden rules that every member is expected to live up to as regularly as clockwork every single day. 1. I promise to do the things my parents tell me to do because they know what's best for me and I want them to be proud of me.
Aww.
2. I promise to get plenty of exercise, indoors and out, because exercise and fresh air keep me healthy and strong. I promise to study hard at school and at home, because I want to have a good, keen mind. and I also promise to avoid danger by looking in every direction before crossing roads. That doesn't really match, do they?
Clean mind, so that's you two ruled out then.
Keen.
Oh, right, I think it's a clean.
I promise to get lots of good sound sleep. Well, that's you outside, Mark.
Yeah, that's me ruined. Another fail for me.
I promise to eat the things my mother wants me to eat, like vegetables and fruits. I promise to drink Ovaltine regularly every day. I thought this was going to come up. I promise to be a loyal member of the League of Ovaltinis by learning all the rules by heart, never revealing the official secrets to anyone, and by listening to the Ovaltini programme, which is broadcast for my special benefit and entertainment every Sunday afternoon from 5:30 to 6 p.m. from Radio Luxembourg. They managed to slip that in subtly.
Yeah. I just noticed as well, there's the secret high sign. And it's high, spelled H-I-G-H. When you meet other members of the League of Ovaltinis, you should give them the secret high sign as a salute. Hey, I'm really high. It's like a peace sign.
There's mystery codes.
Official whistle.
We shall put copies of that on our Tumblr page, listeners. Links, of course, in the show notes as ever. That will go on display in... I think we'll put one copy on display in the library for regular consultation.
That's a beautiful thing.
We'll put one copy on in one of the exhibition hall's display cases. And I think we'll put another one in the loo, shall we, for...
Just in case we run out, yes.
Yeah.
Might make the staples rusty.
I was checking out my... You know my avatar that I have on Facebook?
Mm-hmm.
Which is me in my cardboard box that the Rev painted. And I was looking for... Just check that I had any other versions of it. And I saw that to just read Charlie Hebdo. And I was thinking, guys, it's a bit of a pity that... there's one of those little thumbnail... painted sketches by the Rev of me and of the Rev and of Al. That's not one of you two. It's a pity, that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Or is it a pity, computer?
No, Doc. It is not a pity.
Right, would you like her to accompany me into the atrium, gentlemen? Right. And you'll see in front of us these two giant watercolour canvases that have been delivered from Hull this week. And so... we've got the Hoosium service robots ready to unveil them. So, 1, 2, 3, unveil.
Oh! I thought for a moment I was disco dancing.
Why is my hair, like, smelly and sort of rising to the top of the...
I think he's, for some reason, the Rev has portrayed you as the Joker.
Why? Mark's looks amazing. Mark looks like a cross between Kill Bill and Camberwick Green.
Well, that is one of Bruce Lee's outfits, isn't it? It's Bruce Lee Game of Death outfit.
Oh, it's the Game of Death. Ah, okay. Look at the box. Mark's wearing a box in this illustration by the looks of it.
No, I think that's anatomically probably about right.
Especially with the Liam Gallagher Uno brow as well.
Oh, I don't have one of those, but I'll let that go. But he said...
I don't have green hair.
But my beard is fully full on for that.
Why am I the Joker?
Because you joke a lot and because you're... because you're jammy. I don't know why that makes you...
I think he looks quite like you. And I was trying to work out why. And I'm convinced it's the eyebrows that do it.
Yeah, no, I think facially it looks like Hayden.
I just don't understand the green hair with the weird mohawk going on.
Is this the Joker?
I'm flattered, thank you very much. I just don't know where the hair and the Joker suits come from.
What's Hayden's right hand doing behind that jar of jam? That's why he's smiling.
I've had a look at the way Mark looks, and I'm just feeling to see if things are the same for me down there in that drawing.
That's a jam jar.
Yeah, but it's this was going on behind the jam jar. That's no, that's wonderful. Thank you very much, Andy. I think it's really good. I might have to turn it into my icon.
I love mine. I am properly thrilled. Yeah, mine's awesome. And honestly, I've got quite a big beard at the moment. My hair's grown a bit, though, but yeah. I genuinely thought at first I was disco dancing until I realised what the outfit was. I thought this was me from Hayden's wedding.
Oh, I see what you mean about the eyebrows.
The photos will, of course, go on our Tumblr page. Links in the show notes as ever.
I'm just a bit jealous of Mark's one, that's all, because Mark's one's really impressive.
I know, I'm just completely made up. I would be. I would, if it was the other way around, I'd be like, oh.
I'm just f***ing into a jar on mine. Just
it's jam. You do love jam.
Not that much. No.
Well, I specified the jam to him, and then I asked a few of our podcasting friends, what sort of meme can we use to give the Rev as an idea for doing Mark? And Mark Cockrum suggested, given your affinity for Secret's Army, that we use one of the characters in that. So I thought, what? Just say, put him in an SS uniform.
Oh, that's properly made me laugh.
He's a member of the Gestapo.
But I think Mark's right. I think their faces are...
Yeah, I see what you mean with the eyebrows. That's incredible.
Right, anyway, this week we're going to have a look at The Web of Fear from 1968, second Doctor story, written by Mervyn Haseman and Henry Lincoln. Did they write anything else?
They wrote The Dominators, and they'd previously written The Abominable Snowmen as well.
Oh, right, of course. Directed by Douglas Camfield, produced by Peter Bryant. Hayden, tell us once again the story, tell us the old, old story of your childhood relationship with The Web of Fear and with library finds.
The title of my second autobiography, Library Finds and How I Dodged Them, by Hayden Gribble. Okay, so anyone who has read my book, Child Out of Time, Growing Up with Doctor Who and in the Wilderness Years, which is still available from all good retailers. In that book, I go back to the story of how I discovered the Web of Fear, and that was in the form of a little target book in my school library. This must have been about 1990. Oh, didn't we discover what it was? Because I found the reading recording book, didn't I? Of when I took it out.
Yes.
Recently. I can't remember which episode that was, but it was 96 or 97, I think I discovered that. And my father thought it was too advanced for me at that age. I thought I should try again in a few months.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. I can't remember what episode was that. It was a recent one. It would have been 2 or 3 months ago, I reckon.
Hang on, let's have a look. Hayden's Reading Record Books, podcast 122.
Oh, a bit longer ago then.
November?
Crikey. Wow, okay, yeah, that I literally thought that was a couple of months ago we did that one. Anyway, yeah, so I went back and read it again. Loved it so much that I just kept borrowing it from my local library to the point that I never gave it back. And 2 or 3 years down the line, I met Deborah and Jack Watling at a convention, my very first ever convention. It was in Clacton, so it was on the sort of southeast coast. In fact, actually, Mark, you could say it was a bit of a precursor for Sci-Fi by the Sea in that regard. Yeah, and I admitted my bibliomania to dear old Deborah Watling, and she said to me, leant over the table and said, well, have you written your name in the book? And I said, yeah, I have. And she said, well, it's yours now. And I thought that was utterly delightful. And actually, when I told her that story about 20 years later at one of the Capitol events recently, she remembered it. It's just incredible. Anyway, I absolutely adored that book. That book was amazing. I loved how claustrophobic it was, loved how atmospheric it was. I loved how all of the characters seemed to be three-dimensional. Yes, even Private Evans. I really just absolutely adored it. But there were two things that happened in quick succession which both sort of heightened its legend for me. One of them was that the DWM ran its very first ever episode rankings, like the readers' votes to find what the greatest Doctor Who story of all time was. This would be like DWM 260 or 70 or something like that. And The Web of Fear was in the top 10. In fact, I think it might be 10th. And I thought, oh my God, wow. So this story that I absolutely love is very highly regarded by other Doctor Who fans, which just sort of vindicated it even more to me that this story I'd never seen and only read was one of the best Doctor Who stories ever made. This is amazing. And then there was another thing that happened, which was the television companion book I received that Christmas from my parents, the David J. Howe, Stammers and Stephen James Walker book. And that was when I realised for the first time that everything apart from episode one was missing, which meant I'd never get to see it. And when I did eventually get to see the first episode, it was on the Lost in Time box set, which would have been the mid-noughties, I reckon. So about 10 years after I discovered the book, I thought it was, again, brilliant. I genuinely think it's probably one of the best episode ones in the history of Doctor Who, especially classic Doctor Who. And it was just felt so, just that want for that DVD to keep going and then run straight into episode two was just overwhelming. It's just so unfair that this has to be one of those that is almost fully missing. But thank God we got episode one. And then fast forward several years, and I get a phone call from a friend in fandom who was quite well connected back then, probably still is, because of their placing in fandom, as it were.
Well, clearly you mean someone other than us, Mark.
He called me the same weekend. I don't remember why I remember this so well, but it was the same weekend that The Rings of Akaten came out. So naturally, I needed something to boost my Doctor Who morale again. And he said to me, oh, there's concrete news coming out shortly that Missing Doctor Who episodes are coming back, and Enemy of the World and The Web of Fear are among them. I thought, oh my God, right, well, this is too good to be true, so it clearly isn't going to happen. Fast forward several months, and then, of course, The Web of Fear was announced, barring episode three, which was always such a shame. And after what would have been at that point 17 years since I discovered The Web of Fear, being able to watch it almost complete for the first time was an absolute delight. And it's always been one of my favourite stories, and it will continue to be until the day I snuff it. And at this point, everyone turns off because I've been talking for the last like 40 years and they're all bored by it.
I just popped into the library. Here are your reading record books, Hayden.
Oh, thank you. Oh, yeah, here we go. That's it. Yeah, so it was the 12th of March 1997 when I read to page 10. And my father wrote, many difficult words would advise a change and try later in the year.
I like the fact that you did try later in the year, because I like a few pages on the 22nd of June 97, where it says... Who wrote this bit?
This is my mum.
This is your mum. A little difficult, but I fear Hayden likes it. Which I thought was an interesting choice of words. She fears you like it.
Yeah. You can tell which one was the biggest Doctor Who fan, because my dad actually wrote out the word doctor and my mum abbreviated to Dr. Who.
The big thing about The Web of Fear, of course, is that for a long time, it was classed among the missing episodes.
Mm.
Those recordings which the BBC had either thrown away or recorded over. So for a long time, as Hayden says, only episode one existed in the BBC's vaults. And that was released on the Lost in Time DVD set, I remember, along with other orphaned episodes. But episodes 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 were missing until Phil Morris...
We're named the Dog Indiana.
Famously recovered copies of all the tapes except episode 3 from a TV station in Nigeria. And at midnight on 11th of October 2013, as part of Doctor Who's 50th anniversary year, they were released for download on iTunes, along with the also discovered full tapes of Enemy of the World. That was a Thursday night, wasn't it?
Yes.
I remember taking the Friday off work to watch them.
Mm.
I remember being initially outraged as all these episodes were slowly downloading on iTunes. First to completely download was episode 3, so I rushed to play it. And I was outraged to see it was only a Telesnap reconstruction. I was furious. Absolutely furious. They've conned us. All these tapes that they've conned us into buying, not the real tapes at all. And then 30 seconds later, I remember that episode 3 was still missing.
What happened to episode 3? What was the story with that? Did somebody swipe it? Because it's one of the ones that keeps being mentioned as one of the most likely episodes to reappear, isn't it?
Well, he's supposed to have rediscovered it, the whole lot, in Nigeria. Then he went away, came back again, and in between, episode 3 disappeared, didn't it? So someone had whipped it.
What I don't understand is why would anyone go to all the trouble of stealing episode 3 of Web of Fear?
Oh, come on, Mark. There are 7 private film collectors who would buy episode 3 of The Web of Fear in secret. But nobody's going to buy it when it's in Phil Morris's Wigan warehouse.
Ah.
Wrong. It's in my jam pantry.
I'm actually more excited by The Return of Enemy, really, because I hadn't read the novelisation of Enemy as I had many times with Web.
Same here. I've read Web quite a lot when I was a kid. I think because of that Chris Achilleos cover. Looks amazing. And that's one of the big disappointments of the actual TV show itself, isn't it? Is that at no point do lasers or beams of light shoot out of the Yeti's eyes.
Mark, sorry, Doc. I have to just interject for a second. One of the problems with the Web of Fear. That's 2-footed into the groin area, that kind of tackle.
So, Hayden, as someone who probably knows the book better than Terence Dix, which do you think is better, the book or the TV version, now that you've seen everything except episode 3?
Now, so the general consensus is that if you read the books first, and then you become slightly dismayed with the television realisation, because obviously there's no budget with a book. For me, it lent that atmospheric darkness.
Sorry, come on. I privately messaged Andy to say, just shown the boys their portraits. Very pleased, though Hayden remains utterly bemused as to why he's shown us the Joker. And he's just replied, because he grins a lot in his pictures. It was either that or the Cheshire Cat.
Oh, I like that. No, I like that. That's good.
Right, so the general consensus is if you read the book first...
Yeah, but for me, I found that the story just added to that atmosphere of the book, really. That sort of claustrophobic, almost lost in the dark sense of not quite knowing who to trust, not quite knowing who is the person who's in league with the Great Intelligence, why the Yeti are there, why London's been completely overrun. The little glimmer that I had as a kid of The Web of Fear in televisual format was the little segment that's used at the start of More Than 30 Years in the TARDIS, of Jamie asking the newspaper teller, excuse me. And then the web-covered corpse falls to the ground and there's that sign that says, Londoners flee, menace spreads. I just think that's absolutely wonderful. No, watching this as a 24-year-old when it came back, just made me love it even more. The fact that it was now there and it was tangible, being able to watch this thing again. And I know episode 3 is still out there, and I know it hopefully will come back again one day. But just to have so much more of this story, and I'm not certain if... I think this story did have telesnaps, but I think I stopped buying DWM before the telesnaps were published for this. So I'd never even seen the telesnaps for this thing at all. So I didn't know what anyone looked like apart from, obviously, Sergeant Arnold and obviously Lethbridge Stewart. And I knew what Anne Travers looked like thanks to DWM. And I knew what Professor Travers looked like, of course, because I'd seen the second episode of The Abominable Snowman.
I thought you were going to say, because you'd seen the illustrations inside the Target novelisation of The Abominable Snowman.
Yes, because they're so accurate. No, it was the... But these characters I sort of drawn up in my head, now I can actually... I had something tangible to attach them to. And the one I was really blown away by was episode 4. I always knew how great episode 1 was, but episode 4, that Battle of Covent Garden, is like something out of the Pertwee years. That's completely before its time. You know, of course, it's Douglas Canfield. I never knew Douglas Canfield was the director until the whole thing came back as well. I thought, oh, bloody hell, this is going to be even better. But the way that was filmed...
It's quite reminiscent of... It reminded me a little bit of The War Machines.
Because of Covent Garden.
Yeah, yes, I was going to say Invasion. for the same reason.
But yeah, but Invasion's after, isn't it? So I was just more trying to disprove that it was ahead of its time.
Oh, right.
Oh, thanks. Cheers.
Oh, it's... I see we've turned full circle, have we, Mark, after us being the one attacking Hans of Nyman. Or rather, turned half circle.
I was going to say, you've just dropped your Nyman badge, Mark.
Can we have a break in a minute for 5 minutes? Because I need the toilet and I could do with a quick puff and a fag and get a drink of water, if that's all right.
Should we have an intermission?
Can we do it around about 8? Because that's when the clapping goes on.
Oh, that's a great idea, actually. That's perfect. Well done. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I didn't realise what the actual time was.
Yeah, we've only got about 7-8 minutes. So.
Yeah, no, that's fine. God, last week, did I tell you about last week when I went out for the clapping? And I stood there. It was only 7:58, and I was stood there on the street, and this old woman was walking up down the road, clapping really enthusiastically at 7:58, and she started giving me filthy looks and started shouting, "Come on, start clapping at me!" Like, but it's not 8 o'clock, and she didn't take any notice what I was saying. She's giving me filthy looks. It's like I've gone out there to clap, but I wasn't going to clap 2 minutes early.
For those of you not in the UK, faithless listeners, what's happening is that it's been going on for quite a while, hasn't it? During this lockdown, at 8 p.m. on every Thursday evening, half the country comes to their front doors. So it's one of the few times we actually see our neighbours, and gives a nationwide round of applause to people like the National Health Service and nurses and doctors and carers, and it's quite extraordinary here. Around here, they seem to do it mainly with banging pots and pans. Do they do it? Are they quite good about doing it in your place?
Yeah. We've only got one neighbour who doesn't do it, and
of course we're all really good about this in the in Biscuit Factory Square. Oh, by the way, I don't think I've ever mentioned the town that we're in, have we? Here at in Mummerset. It's, of course, the town was famously founded at a crossing over the River Leth, and so it's called Lethbridge.
Hooray!
So we're all very good in here in Lethbridge as well, but in fact we've got 5 minutes to go until 8 o'clock. We'll be going to the front door of the Hoosier, and we'll see the bishop will come to the front door of St. Adric's Cathedral. The owner of the Cardoma Cafe will come to the door of his cafe, which obviously has been boarded up since the lockdown began.
The fire brigade will be out there, won't they? Hugh and the other ones.
Oh, pew pew, Barney McGrew, Cuthbert Dublinkrow.
Yes, that's him.
Right, we better head out there then.
Right, so should we have a break? We'll have an intermission.
Yeah, okay.
During this. Okie doke.
Ice cream, or maybe some nuts, a cool glass of orange, why not try a hot dog? From the sales staff and in the foyer, now.
May we remind you that for the convenience of those patrons who prefer not to smoke, seating areas on the right-hand side of this auditorium have been designated as no-smoking areas. Your cooperation is appreciated.
Right, we're coming up to 8 o'clock now, so let's pop outside out, shall we? Could you open the front doors, please, and switch on the external microphones? Thank you. Oh, what a lovely night. Oh, Lord, it's the Tom Baker lookalike. 83-year-old Margaret from down the road. She's early as usual.
Where are you?
No, we're not going to start any. Quick, let's dodge behind this 30-foot porphyry caryatid of Daphne Ashbrook.
Where are you? Where are you? Lesbia Avenue! Come on!
Yeah, I don't think she's seen us. We're just coming up to it. Right, this clapping and banging of pots and pans usually lasts a good 4 minutes. So what I'll probably do is edit it down later to only 1 minute. So that we're both allowing the faithless listeners to join in on Marmoset's tribute and at the same time not trying their patience too much. Just coming up to it. Thank you, computer. You can close the doors now, please. When did you first see it, Mark? Did you download it on the day, or did you have to wait to get a DVD or something?
It was... do you know what? I still don't own it. Both times I've watched it, I've streamed it. Well, I watched it on Daily Motion both times.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
No, I got it at a later date. Much later, in fact. I didn't get it for years until I managed to get it a bit discounted. Not because of any problem with the Web of Fear, I really wanted to see it, but because I was tight and or skinned.
So what did you make of it then, Mark? What did you think?
What do I think of it?
Yeah.
Do you ask you for trouble, Aidan?
Mm.
Going back to that Covent Garden bit, I do have to say, when you get to that bit in episode 4, it is the sudden realisation that it's coming up to the Covent Garden bit, and there is a sort of punch the air. It's like, yes, it's this bit, I love it. And you know that Douglas Canfield's going to do a good job of filming it. And the whole thing, this is a tour de force of quality Douglas Canfield directing. The compositions he puts in the frame are just a different level to most jobbing directors. Is the absolute artwork. There's certain frames of it. I think episode 1, there's a bit where they're in the tunnel and the three of them hide in that little cubby hole bit as the soldiers walk past, and then their heads all poke out at the same time.
Oh yeah, 1, 2, 3.
Yes, like
that's
that.
Brilliant.
And it's just brilliant. And then I think,
in fact, considering they're theoretically supposed to be wandering all around the circle line, they all hide in that same cubbyhole quite a lot, don't they, during the story?
Yeah, yes, they do. There's another bit as well, which, just as an example, is composition. I mean, as well as the shots of the tunnel itself and the Yetis coming through the tunnel, which look incredible. There's that one shot, I think it's when it's in episode 4, and the Doctor's face is right up close to the camera, and just over his shoulder on one side you can see Lethbridge Stewart, and on the other side you can see Captain Knight. And it's just a bit where the Doctor says, "And one of us here is still working for the Great Intelligence," and you just, it's that three shot you've got with the Doctor in the foreground, and but they look at each other as well, but it's Patrick's in the
computer. Can you bring up Mark's photo, please? Oh, it's that. Yeah, that's wonderful.
But there's a bit where they both look at each other, but Troughton's head's in the foreground, but they look at each other behind him, and just as he says it, it's just it could just be three people stood talking in a room, and it would have been fine. But it's the fact that they doing that as it's proper art.
Put it this way, Hayden.
Yeah.
If you want an idea of what Mark and I thought of the book, both of us returned it promptly to the library before the expiration date.
It's probably so I could get out another book on Kung Fu. Not enough martial arts in this.
Kung Fu and cod pieces, apparently. But... that's going to send all our listeners hastening to the Tumblr page.
Well, that's the name of the podcast, isn't it? It's Kung Fu and Cod Pieces. Dear, oh dear.
Oh, that's good, actually. I think that's right. Kung Fu and... I'm going to make a note of that. You were talking about the dead newspaper seller, Hayden.
Yeah.
I do think one of the weaknesses of this story is the way our suspension of disbelief gets stretched to breaking point, as yet again we find ourselves in a deserted London, like Invasion of the Dinosaurs. I mean, is it really credible that people would just desert the streets of a major city on the say-so of the government? It's so unrealistic. By the way, changing the subject entirely, did I mention that when I was queuing for the supermarket last week, I saw a fox in Piccadilly? Actually, that doesn't mean anything these days. You see foxes all over the city, don't you? Yeah. No nightingale singing in Berkeley Square, though.
It truly is a golden age.
I think Mark makes a good point there, that what he was saying about some of the framing of
yes,
some of the shots, in that it doesn't excite me, this story. My opinion is, I think it's the 6 episodes thing. It is a bit too much of running through the tunnels. Yes. I mean, that battle in the open air is really welcome. But the actual stuff they're doing during that is high quality.
Yes, absolutely. This story is too long, and it's too dark in tone. I mean, too dark on screen, too dark a subject matter, I feel, almost, to sustain over 6.
Well, you would, because you're coming from Lord Nymon over there. God.
Over 6 episodes. It's a long time to stay. I mean, how... Those sets are brilliant, but how much time do they spend on those sets? It's, I mean, so what, 70% of it is just in a dark tunnel, which I think 6 episodes is too long to spend that much time, which is probably why I love the Covent Garden bit so much.
Yeah, particularly in that era where watching it in black and white, cleaned up now, that's gloomy enough, but that's from 1968, that must have been very dark.
Yes, you imagine trying to look at it on one of those little sort of 12-inch
bulging telescreens. I'm hearing this.
Because the Tube set, London Underground sets, were famously, weren't they, so accurate that the BBC was accused of illegally filming on London transport property?
Wait a second. So let me get this straight. You two don't enjoy the story much because of its bleakness. And yet you will happily sit through hours upon hours of Secret Army and Blake 7.
Yes, but Blake 7 is brightly lit and June Hudson does the costumes. So, you know.
So if the Web of Fear was more like the Twin Dilemma, then you'd have got on better with it, would you?
Secret Army and Blake 7 are bleak emotionally, Hayden. Yeah. What we're saying is that Web of Fear is bleak just visually.
Yes.
Lots of it.
But surely it's worse to be bleak mentally than it is. So look, it's like if I was standing in a room full of goths, I'd think, bloody hell, this looks bleak. But actually you start talking to them and then you get a bit more context as to why they dress up in such a way. And actually they're quite a cheery bunch.
Are they? I've never had such a night out.
What was lovely in... these things we've all linked together, the Yeti, the London Underground, the 50th anniversary, was, of course, I'm the only one of the three of us who actually regularly uses the Underground. But as you go in, what they have in the ticket hall of London Underground stations, Faithful Sisters, for those of you who don't know, are these things which are like, they're about perhaps maybe 5 or 6 feet tall. It's like a freestanding display poster. Come whiteboard. So eventually they write messages on it with markers saying things like, there's a delay between, you know, this station and that station. And someone had put on the sign as you were going through the turnstiles, warning, Yeti on the Underground. Happy 50th birthday, Doctor.
Oh,
which is lovely. That
I love
sort of
that.
There are a lot of deaths in this, aren't there?
Yeah. Going back to that Covent Garden scene, that's really quite affecting because he goes out there with his Lethbridge Stewart, I'm trying not to say the Brigadier all the time, goes out.
I know, it's difficult, isn't it?
It's really difficult. He goes out there with his crew, and they get massacred, basically, don't they? Mm-hmm. And that bit where he comes back and he makes it back into the headquarters and he's just leaning there and he just says, gone, all of them.
That scene where they're up on those crates and the Yeti just grabs the ankle of one of the corporals and yanks him off and belts him.
I think we're watching the wrong web of fear.
Hayden, he got no shame. I felt sorry for Craftsman Weems. Mm. It's a strange name, isn't it? Weems.
Mm. Yeah.
Craftsman apparently in the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers is the equivalent of being called a sapper in the Royal Engineers or a gunner in the Royal Artillery.
I think that death toll, the Covent Garden death toll, weighs a bit on Colonel Lethbridge-Stewart as well. I think it's character forming, isn't it? You get to see him being heroic and you get to see him caring about his men. And then I think shortly after that, that he's going through the tunnels with Jamie and they pull open this door and I'm not sure what's behind it. What's going on there in that?
It's that glowing thing.
It's some sort of big plastic glowing thing behind it, isn't it? And they're struggling to keep the door closed. And the Brigadier just says to Jamie, look, you go. And I just think at that point, Lethbridge-Stewart's felt that he's seen too much death, to be honest. And I think he's trying to redeem him. He's personally trying to redeem himself, perhaps, by saying to Jamie, look, you go. I'm not letting you die as well.
You're right, it is character forming. But I've always seen that if there's an awful lot of death in something, it lends a lot of seriousness to the narrative as well.
Yes.
And that's what I like, is this, actually, you've got this doctor who we sometimes... Okay, yeah, the second doctor's a bit of a manipulator, but he's can be a bit of a clown as well. And he is very much a very serious doctor in this story. There's not much time for him to be playing around, and in that way, I sort of liken Trant's portrayal here as his turn in The Evil of the Daleks, where apart from the scene where you've got, oh, look, Jamie, they think they're trains, they're taking me for a ride. Mm-hmm. Apart from that bit, he's definitely serious throughout that story as well. You know, and that glimmer in the moon base, you know, there are some corners of the universe which have bred the most terrible things. You know, it's just, it's, if my doctor has taken a more serious tone on, then I'm going to be thinking, oh, crikey, the stakes really are high here. He's not even really like that in the War Games, where the game is truly up for him. He's very serious here in the Web of Fear, and it's left to other characters like Evans, and obviously Jamie as well, to maybe have a little bit more of that light relief there. And, of course, Travers, who's quite laughable in some places, but there you go.
Yeah, I think the second Doctor's having quite a good time at the start of episode one, by the look of it.
Oh, he's...
Why?
With Victoria there on the floor of the TARDIS. And all that, woo! And screaming and him grappling with her from behind.
Yeah.
I thought, it's a bit steamy. And then Jamie joins in.
Yeah, and that's a real menage a trois, that one.
Yeah, crikey. I was tugging at my collar. I said collar.
Absolutely. Actually, in that first episode, you know, the bit when he gets the box out, the jamming thing for Jamie. He says, oh, what's he going to do? Oh, nothing. And Jamie goes, oh, no. Just drops it back into his lap. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, the chemistry with that TARDIS team's brilliant. And that it's particularly good in that first episode. I do think, I hate to say it because I don't like to be mean to Deborah Watling, but I think, I mean, she does the ingenue quite well, but... Yeah.
I don't think it's Deborah Watling. I think it's the
character.
I completely agree.
But there's still chemistry between all three, isn't it? And they do feel like a proper family, like two young...
Yes.
Like a young girl, an older brother, and their mad uncle off out on an adventure. And you do feel that bond with them. So clearly, when you listen to interviews, Patrick Trouton's... and Fraser Hines and Deborah Watling had great fun recording together, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Running her knickers up the flagpole. Was that Wendy Padbury?
That's Wendy Padbury. Oh, no. That was Deborah Watling, and it was Wendy Padbury who, she fell asleep, so they unfastened her dungarees or something.
And
they were rehearsing in the church, and they said, quick, you're on. So she then legged it out, but left all her clothes behind, and ran into the vicar, and then... did a little curtsy and ran off again.
The other great thing about episode one is that filmed segment that they have right near the beginning, just after the TARDIS bit.
Which one is that?
Very Hammer Horror. It's an Ingenious Silver Science Museum.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, yeah, everything. The music, the lighting, the tone of it, everything just looks like a classic black and white horror film. Even the stock music that they have on it as well, which I bet was from some, been used in some horror film before. And the way the Yeti's eyes light up.
Well, the way that it metamorphosizes from the old Yeti into the new one, you know, it almost regenerates, doesn't it? And it's that Silverstein's blowing out the candles, which adds more shadow and more gloominess to that look. And it's, it's wonderful.
Yeah, again, brilliant. I think it's that Camfield touch as well.
It is.
His control of, like I say, what goes on in the frames, just beautiful. And it's all very Quatermass at first, isn't it?
Yes.
It feels very much like Doctor Who, the children's programme, has suddenly landed in the middle of a Quatermass movie.
Yeah, well, I suppose in that sense it is. It's that stepping stone towards UNIT, isn't it? Which is where Derek Sherwin did want to take the series, as almost like Quatermass, you know, with the Doctor being on Earth. This is that first stepping stone to, well, possibly, arguably second after the War Machines when it comes to contemporary Earth stories. But this one feels definitely more Quatermass than the War Machine, certainly.
Yes.
Even though I love both. I think that first episode, I really do honestly, truly think this. I think if you would take individual episodes into account, I think it really is one of the strongest setups in any of Classic Who. That first episode is brilliant. That is a slight disappointment for me. Yes, I do have a criticism of The Web of Fear, is that there wasn't more film segments throughout. I think there could have been more of a credence towards maybe a bit more light later on in stories, like when they are in the tunnels.
Mm.
That tunnel set, when it's on film, seems to be a little brighter lit than when it's shot on videotape, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
You can see a bit more, and you can see a bit more in the shadows, as opposed to here are just the characters and someone's forgotten to turn the light on. But, Mark, how dare you? You just made me criticise one of my favourite stories. I found a criticism. This isn't right.
Talking of Silverstein, I learned some things I had no idea of before when I was researching this. Julia Silverstein was renamed, I think, in Terence Dix's novelisation, he renamed Emile Julius, because I think Terence Dix felt that being a sort of greedy and grasping collector wasn't was a bit of an offensive Jewish stereotype. But apparently in the Lethbridge Stewart series, they're called Candy Jar.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, that's the publisher.
Yeah, which I haven't read, but it must be marvellous, because Rob from Fortitude to Doomsday is one of them writers, isn't he?
Yeah, my friend Nick reads them and he says they're great. So I should probably check them out sometime.
They merged the two names together to call him Emile Julius Silverstein and explained away Travers addressing him as Julius in that he was using his middle name as an insult. I don't quite get, really. So, Robert.
Ha! How dare you?
That's Mark's written name, by the way, not referring to Rob on Fortitude to Doomsday. But it's a pity we miss him, his introduction. But the Brigadier in this is absolutely, I think, finally, he's absolutely extraordinary.
Mm.
I mean, I think the next to Patrick Charlton himself is clearly the biggest character in this. And I think what's extraordinary is that that character that he almost in the first episode, that's the character he has almost until they start turning into a bit of a buffoon in The Three Doctors, isn't it? He's that sort of, I think I read someone once describing it as both sarcastic and officious.
Well, before you begin this rapturous reunion, there are one or two questions I'd like answered. For a start, is anyone else down here playing hide and seek?
Which is quite true, isn't it? He'll be sticking to rules and regulations, but he'll do it in quite a sarcastic way in his early days. And clearly that he must have impressed someone, because they've brought him back for Invasion and then for the whole of the Pertwee era. I think he's wonderful. initially I thought it was weird how he just turns up out of nowhere. You know, the Doctor says, oh, here's someone I met in the tunnels. It wasn't, you know, we didn't actually see them meeting. But I think it's possible that probably they're doing that in order to try and make him a credible potential villain. Oh, he's just been found wandering in the tunnels. Well, how do we know he's really a brigadier, a colonel? He automatically believes in the TARDIS. He says to Evans, who are you? Oh, I'm the one who drove you to Holborn. Oh, yes, so you did.
Mm.
And it doesn't really work, of course, because most of us came to this after we already know the Brigadier is one of the good guys.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
They're clearly trying to set the idea that he could be one of the baddies. Oh, I think he's absolutely wonderful. And on the subject of UNIT, this, of course, is famously the original source of the UNIT dating controversy.
Mm.
I think it's mainly at the fault of Anne Travers and Professor Travers, in that she suggests that they both met in 1935, and then he suggests that it's 40 years since they've met.
Yes.
Which then makes this 1975. Which, considering all of it, that between 1970 and 75 itself, we have a whole pile of further UNIT adventures.
Yeah, and so it's only 2 years later that the Brigadier, that he's retired and has become a school teacher.
Yes, of course. Fortunately, it's not the sort of thing I care about.
No. To be fair, I mean, this and all the other UNIT adventures were incredibly traumatising for the Brigadier, so maybe he did age 15 years in that time.
And also, he has his first meeting with one of his soon-to-be unit members, isn't he? John Levine is playing one of the Yetis.
Oh, yes. And also, I saw Derek Martin turn up, who's one of Havoc.
Oh, yeah, that's Cat Slater's dad, isn't it? In EastEnders.
Yes, yeah.
Look at it, sir. Yeah, he's just gone round me cab, look.
He must be off his chump. That is an actual line of dialogue from this episode somewhere, isn't it? One of them says, must be off his chump.
So who have we had? We've had Captain Knight is played by Ralph Watson, who was also Arthur Scargill, or the Ettis in The Monster of Pemberton. Yeah. And Ben, the tall, thin guy who gets killed early on in Fangrock. Staff Sergeant Arnold is played by Jack Woolgar, who famously... Well, not famously, but I didn't actually see this, but I remember reading the books avidly when I was a child. Played Professor Brainstorm in the 1969 series The Incredible Adventures of Professor Brainstorm. Corporal Blake, who I think is the guy who gets... Well, he either gets yanked off by his ankle during that battle or killed over the counter of that shop they go into, was played by Richardson Morgan, who also played Rogan in Ark of Space. There'll be a snitch up guy. Craftsman Weems is played by Stephen Whittaker, who didn't seem to have done much, but actually went on to become a very, very successful director. Professor Travers reminds me a little bit of Professor Horner in The Demons. You've got another professor being grumpy with a TV presenter. Although he's a little one note here. He's constantly grumpy for it. Who played Anne Travers? That was...
I've got that written down because I liked it a lot. Tina Packer.
Packer?
Yeah, Packer.
She starts off, at the very beginning, she starts off being quite annoyingly posh and prim, doesn't she? But she very quickly turns from that into what I think I might have described on here earlier as a sort of precursor to Liz Shaw.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
If that makes sense.
I think she's really good. A beautifully written role for a woman at this time in the show's history.
Mm.
Although we had just had Enemy of the World as well, which also featured...
Oh, with the fabulous Faria.
Yes, not to mention...
Mary Peach.
Those of us who've been with us longer than most will know. I won't go into too much into the extent to which I worship Carmen Monroe.
Hmm.
Plays Salamander's food taster in Enemy of the World, but possibly the only decent black role there's been until Brigadier Bambera in Battlefield. But
I think sadly, you're probably right.
But then, to be fair, there's not a lot to compare it with, isn't there? It's mainly who's the fellow who played almost exactly the same role in both Terror of the Autons and Tomb of the Cybermen? Roy Stewart, is it? He's both Toberman and the guy who threatens the Doctor at the circus. And they're essentially quite stereotypes, aren't they?
Yeah.
But she has a relatively small role. But when she dies at the end, it's absolutely heartbreaking, isn't it? But yes, I thought Anne Chavez was a great character.
What else was John Rollison in? He's the guy who played Chorley, isn't he?
Yes, and the guy what I do remember from the book is that he was the one that I thought, right until the last minute, I bet it's him.
Oh yeah, same here. He was completely set up as that red herring, wasn't he?
Yeah, and then he disappears, and it's like, yeah, definitely him.
Yeah, disappears for a couple of episodes, yeah.
It's not the Welsh guy, because that seemed too obvious.
I love his what he must regard as his ultimate insulting put-down to Anne, when she's accusing him of being a cheap, sensationalist journalist. He says to her, "You smug little red brick university," and then gets cut off with it. Clearly, that's the height of a put down for him. But very mature, I think. Not only in the fact that she's a scientist, but she is independent. She's not just there to provide cue lines or react to cue lines from other characters.
Derek Pollitt, who did the Welsh guy?
I don't find much about him. If we're talking about women are written better these days than they were in 1968. I also suspect that Welsh men are as well. Yeah. The Doctor of all people calling a blithering Welsh imbecile.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, being a Welsh-born chap myself.
Being a blithering Welsh imbecile yourself.
Being a blithering Welsh imbecile, I can tell you, I was not impressed.
I tell you, I was not impressed, I was not.
Oh.
Why'd you never call us Boyo, Mark?
It's a term of affection.
Charming. I do think that... I almost found this scarier in the book, actually, but I'm not sure. Apart from the one scene, the whole which one is our Yeti?
Hmm.
Once it gets mixed up with the others and... Jamie's there in the tunnel saying, "Come towards me." And a Yeti's coming towards me. Oh, bloody hell.
That bit's like he's shouting into his mobile phone on his Tinder, isn't it? "Come towards me. I'm on the platform at Piccadilly Station."
A couple of things about the background. Obviously, there's the Camfield's chocolate bar that comes out of the machine, which I think was quite nice.
Yeah.
That film poster.
Blockbusters
with Sidney Poitier and Rod Steiger. You would not believe how long I spent trying to find that on Google in preparation for this. And slightly found someone saying it's actually a poster for In the Heat of the Night, but with the title covered up with a fake one.
Oh.
Clearly the BBC might be thinking, oh, we can't advertise a recent film because we're the BBC.
Well, maybe it's because it's supposed to be set in 1975, so they'd have had a new film poster up by then.
Oh, that's the point. A bit like the... My mistakenly downloading episode 3 from iTunes. I was getting really, really annoyed. God, what, this IMDb is supposed to have everything in it. I can't, they've not even got this. How are they incompetent? But it's, I would say, a damn good Doctor Who story. I think possibly when Mark and I weren't being as fulsome as Hayden, it's more a case of, it's not one of those that for us stands out as amazing.
Computer? Yeah, could you just get up my list of enemies, please, on the screen? Yeah, could you add Doc's name to it, please? Thank you. Thanks very much.
Well, hang on, Hayden. It's still scrolling down. Still scrolling. Still scrolling.
Oh, nope. There's another couple of pages to go yet.
I'm on it 7 times.
Here you go. You got it. It's at the bottom now, Hayden. You can put me on as number 189. But hang on. By an extraordinary coincidence, wasn't that position of the Horns of Nymon in the DWM's Mighty 200?
You know what, Doc? You might have just said, oh yes, and not that I'm, I was going to say dick swaying here. but in that Mighty 200, the Web of Fear was 16th. So.
Oh, you went and looked. I do.
Right, I can put it away again now.
Dougie Camfield, so he I've got in here that he was noted for his direction of the military matters. I think that mainly stems from Tom saying that in the Tom Baker year. It's amazing how much my opinion of Doctor Who is dictated by having watched those tapes. Where he says, it must have been Dougie Canfield directing The Seeds of Doom because it's a very military, exact performance for everyone. So he's done this, he's done Seeds of Doom, Inferno, which is a lot of units in military in there, wasn't there? No, not Inferno. Yes, there was actually, wasn't there? And The Invasion, which there was. Terror of the Zygons, again, it's another, those are the only ones he did.
Many.
This, Seeds, Inferno, Invasion, and Terror. Of course, he died young, didn't he? Is there anything that you think, you were talking earlier, Mark, about his framing of shots. Is that something you think that carries on through that list of stories, or is it something you definitely
look closer? No, definitely. You can definitely see it in all of his work, I think. Didn't he also direct the fight scenes in the first ever Doctor Who story, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah, the fight scenes between Cal and
the other
caveman now. Yeah. Yes, he did. I mean, I'm just trying to tally up now, and I think he directed 4 out of 10 of my favourite all-time Doctor Who stories, Douglas Canfield, so...
Yes, quite possibly.
He was production assistant on Unearthly Child and Marco Polo. He directed Episode 3 of Plans of Giants. He directed The Crusade, Time Meddler, Dalek Master Plan, Web of Fear, Invasion Inferno, Terror of the Zygons, Seeds of Doom. And of course, if he was the director, then he must have been responsible for casting Nick Courtney, wasn't he?
Yes, well, wasn't he? He was supposed to play Captain Knight, Nicholas Courtney, but then the person who was supposed to play him, I can't remember what happened now, but either fell out with Douglas Canfield or just completely left the project. And at that point, he promoted Nicholas Courtney to Brigadier. And he also, I'll just say on his resume as well, Douglas Canfield also directed things such as Zed Cars, The Sweeney, The Professionals, Out of the Unknown, and Ivanhoe in the 50s with Roger Moore. Oh, no, he didn't. Sorry, he did the 1982 television movie. Oh, that's a shame. What a come down.
And, of course, he's one of the faces in the Brain of Morbius, isn't he? Which I still refuse to believe has been explained by...
Yes. Of course, he played the Chibbers. Doctor, yes. Yes, Douglas Canfield was the Doctor as well.
So, Hayden, why don't you finish this off for us? I'm going to say, Hayden, why don't you finish us off?
I did have one point that's not been brought up, which is, it's interesting, isn't it, that he just uses stock music all the way through this.
Oh, does he?
He didn't get on with Dudley Simpson. They had a falling out during...
No, he Giants, didn't.
I can't remember over what now, but yeah, it was...
Who did? Canfield?
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so all the music in this is stock music, isn't it? But they use the, what's it called? The Spacewalk? The Cyberman music.
Oh, yeah, I noticed that. I thought, I was thinking when I was watching this the other day, was I mistaken? Because I was sure that was two of the Cybermen.
It's called Space Adventure, isn't it?
Space Adventure, thank you, yes.
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
It's a cracking bit of music.
So... Marks out of 10. I'd give it a 7.5.
I think what this story does well, it does very well. Like I say, my only criticisms really being that it's just, I feel it's a bit too long and a bit padded out in places. A bit too much to and froing, which happens in a lot of 6-episode Who. But I'd still give it an 8.
Oh, well, you've redeemed yourself there, sir. You've redeemed yourself with that last mark. It is interesting, Mark, because both you and I have overlapping music tastes. I'm sure that progressive rock is on your list, isn't it? And I mean, a lot of that's quite that's quite long and overdrawn, isn't it? So I just wonder why you herald acts such as Black Sabbath and King Crimson, but absolutely detest the Web of Fear.
I detest the Web of Fear at all.
Hayden, Mark's out of 10.
Oh, for me, this is I adore it. I take on board what you say about the darkness. Oh, it's so bleak. But I think this is the height for me of Patrick Troughton as the Doctor. And he's my Doctor in a bizarre, peculiar, timey-wimey way. He's the Doctor I grew up with. And I think the chemistry between himself, Fraser Hines and Deborah Watling, it's at the zenith here for that TARDIS trio. It's the introduction of Lethbridge Stewart to the series. This is highly important serial for that. It's iconic. Because it was lost for so long, it was given such a high status. This is one of the holy grails of Doctor Who, and to get this back was utterly joyous. And I absolutely love it. I love the story. I love it. It's a 10 for me. I think there is only one other Doctor Who story that is better than this for me. And that...
Kroll?
Where?
That story is Mary Tam's dress.
Yeah. No, my favourite all-time Doctor Who story is Pyramids of Mars.
Ah.
And this is the second for me. I love it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because for me, would you say this is your favourite Troughton season?
Oh. Do you know what? I mean, this is the thing. When we get around to doing the second Doctor retrospective, I'm going to have a serious problem trying to collate my favourite. Because after the Web of Fear, there's about 6 or 7 stories jostling for second place. And they cover the breadth of season 4 through to the end of season 6.
I didn't realise that Webb came so soon after Abominable.
Yeah, he did.
I thought it was a couple of seasons. So this is what? Tomb, Abominable Snowman, Ice Warriors, Enemy,
yep.
Web of Fear, Fury, and Wheel in Space.
I mean, as a season, that is bloody strong, but when watched all together, the base under siege element of them all does tend to wear things. I'm intrigued as to see how different Fury from the Deep is going to be, because I think after Fury, it started to change and become... I think by that point, Derek Sherwin and Terrence Dix had their feet under the desk, as it were, a little more, didn't they? And I think they do start to steer it away a bit from base under siege after this one. I think for its variedness and... I hate to say it because I did love Deborah Watling, but with a better companion in place in the form of Zoe, season 6 is probably better overall.
Okay, that's interesting, because that's kind of where I'd go. And one of the reasons for that is because I find that TARDIS team more fun, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah.
There's something quite joyous about them romping through time and space.
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
And for me, that sort of makes season 6... my preferred one, although I do have to agree they're both very good seasons.
Yeah.
It's interesting with Victoria, and I emphasise Victoria as opposed to Debbie Watling, how she's actually, contrary to popular belief, she's the exception to the rule, isn't she, with Doctor Who female companions, is that she is a sort of a cowering, Doctor, I'm so scared thing. Mm. She's very much the exception to the rule rather than that being the typical. You get Barbara isn't like that. Susan, she doesn't do a lot of, oh, grandfather, I've twisted my ankle, but she makes up for it by being mysterious. Vicky,
do you know what? I think we need to do a companions episode one day soon.
What, a companion, where's the apostrophe with the companions?
Oh, after the S, sorry.
All right, all the companions for me, right, yes.
Do one of our polls.
Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
And let's have a good talk about companions.
Right. We'd like to remind you, faithful listeners, to all... We've already had several votes come in for Peter Davison era retrospective, so please get them in. We'll probably start putting some unsubtle reminders up on social media soon.
Oh, I've just realised that's going to bugger up my rewatch of the Graham Williams era. I'm going to somehow have to crunch season 15 in the next sort of week or two before we do Peter Davison, aren't I?
Well, I think it's possible then, as a closing remark, I think it's possible that In Your Eyes, Hayden, Patrick Troughton here has even exceeded the achievement of his predecessor, don't you?
Yes. Absolutely, of course, yes.
Oh, hang on, who's this? Who's this going down? Oh, good Lord!
Who?
Mr. Hartnell!
Yes? Yes, dear boy, who's this Patrick Troughton, which I've heard so much about. I heard him down the corridor.
Mr. Hartnell, I've always wanted to ask you, out of all your Doctor Who stories, what is your favourite public health poster?
Dear boy, it has to be Don't Dump Bodies... Into the River. Yes. Much better than sugar puffs. I never liked those puffs. No, I don't like those puffs.
Mr. Hartnell, we have complicated lines in Sector 27.
It's a crab!
Bye, everyone.
Good night.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting, fitted in your ear.